Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is January 17th, 2019. It's a rainy and somewhat gloomy day here in Nashville. Those of you who know me would certainly be aware of the fact that before retiring from law practice, I spent a couple decades assisting claimants in the Social Security disability process. When I first started doing this type of work, there were very few, perhaps less than a dozen, attorneys in private practice who handled such cases in the Nashville area. Most attorneys, in fact, are not trained in this area and have little understanding of the process. A couple of weeks ago, the Nashville Tennessean newspaper had a front page featured article which focused on the State of Tennessee Disability Determination section, which is part of the State Department of Human Services. This agency contracts with the federal government, Social Security Administration, and does medical evaluations and decision-making at the first two stages of the Social Security disability claim process. They decide whether people are disabled or not. Those of us who have worked with this agency for many years have long known of its ineffectiveness, and some would say bias, unfavorable to Social Security claimants. I've witnessed firsthand the serious harm which is the result of these disgraceful actions by this agency. Some of us have made serious efforts to effectuate change, but to no avail. Legislators and commissioners and governors don't understand the process any better than most attorneys. The Tennessean article exposed a new element of dysfunction, which I would offer adds an aspect of scandal to the situation. It is reported that certain state agency medical doctors who are contractors and get paid by the case on the case basis have been handling cases in as little as 15 minutes. Reportedly, one doctor made several hundred thousand dollars in 1 year on a part-time basis. And so I wanted to do a podcast on this timely subject. And so I called my friend Bill Benjamin for an interview. Bill is in the unique situation of having worked at the disability service office before he began his law practice. The state is at a place now where it can make needed policy corrections to address this situation. I hope this podcast will provide some needed background so that you, my listeners, will be better informed and able to influence the process if you so desire. And so here's my interview with attorney Bill Benjamin. So Bill Benjamin, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Bill, it's fun to have you. We're, for my listeners, we are sitting in a little different location than normal for our recordings today. So we have some construction type work going on the other end of the house. So if anybody hears some banging or sawing or whatever, that's just disregard that. I hope that it won't be too much to interfere with the interview. Bill, you are an attorney practicing law here in Nashville, and just as full disclosure, you and I have worked closely together over the years. You were one of my students when you were in law school, and now you're involved in the practice of law in with a concentration on Social Security disability work. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right. So tell us about where you're from and how you got to Nashville and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's a little convoluted, but it's a story. I have my uncle who's a he was a musician, and he came to Nashville back in the early 90s, and he was trying to make it big, and it didn't happen. So then he established himself in the real world and got a regular job and got married and had a family, and he invited me down here right around Christmas time for a vacation. And I came, and he had a Christmas party, and there was a young lady at that party who I am now married to.
Ah, okay.
And I happened to meet her just as the company that I was working for went through a downsizing. It was a big corporation. And I was supposed to go to law school when I was up there. and
in Rhode Island.
In Rhode Island. I'm sorry, I left that out. I'm originally from Rhode Island, New England state. And what happened was, after I met her, since I had the company I was working for was going through that tumultuous event and I was going to lose my position, I came down here to Nashville and figured I'd make a start here. And I immediately looked to enroll into law school, and I did, the Nashville School of Law. And I needed a job during the day, so I applied for a bunch of different jobs, and I ended up getting a position with the Disability Determination Section, State of Tennessee.
The State of Tennessee, and so that's why we're here today. You know, I have done 26 or 27 podcasts over the last couple of years, and I've only done one interview with an attorney. In all of those interviews, and I didn't really have in mind I was going to do many more, except that a couple weeks ago, the Tennessean newspaper had a front page story about the Tennessee Disability Determination Services, and I guess you might call it, it's kind of a scandal that has been revealed. Maybe that's too harsh a word. There are some issues and some problems there, that disability determination section.
Yeah, they've had a tough time of it for years before I was even there, and then after. Let me tell you where I left off, where I got the position at the disability determination section, State of Tennessee. Let me tell you how I got that job. I think that'll lay the foundation of what's going on over there, or help to understand the machinations of what goes on over there. You have to take a state test, and I took the state test. You have to have a bachelor's degree to be a disabilities claims examiner, and those are the people in charge of putting together a case to and decide whether someone is disabled or not at the first two levels of being of disability determination. For Social Security, but the Disability Determination Section, State of Tennessee, is a State of Tennessee agency. What happens is the federal government subcontracts them to decide these cases. Right. So when I went in, I took the test, and I was a history major in college. I had zero experience with Social Security matters. I had zero experience with reading medical charts. I was just looking for a job during the day so that I could go to law school at night. It happened to be a wondrous thing. They started a intense training program at that time at the State of Tennessee Disability Determination Section. And the reason they did that, what I was told by the federal people that used to come in and speak with us at the time, was they felt we should be making more money. I went in, I was hired at $26,000 a year. And that was a significant raise from the years prior. The disability examiners used to get hired in at about $22,000 a year, maybe a little bit off, give or take. They did raise the salary a little bit. And by the way, from my understanding, is the new examiners coming in today, 10 years later, 15 years later, I'm getting old, is $26,000 a year. It hasn't gone up.
Wow.
It went up for a while, and then they brought it back down from scuttlebutt that I've heard from examiners that I've known over the years. Anyway, the concession that the federal government made, because the numbers in Tennessee were atrocious, we were at the bottom end of the spectrum compared to other states in the country for allowance rates. Also, our quality was terrible at the time, and they needed this, the federal government wanted this addressed. So the concession they gave was giving extra money for training. So I went through an intense training process, which I think that training program is still there. The trouble is, my graduating class, when I left there, which I was there for 4.5 years, I think when I left, out of 30 or so people, there was probably about 8 left.
Yeah, they move on to something else as soon as they can find a job.
It's quick attrition. Pay them a little more. The big insurance companies come in and they get jobs working for almost twice the money after they've been trained by the disability determination section.
Well, Bill, let's drop back a little bit and maybe give some background. You know, the article in the newspaper 2 weeks ago, and there's been a couple follow-ups since, laid out a problem that you and I are well aware of, but it's a problem that has existed in that agency for many years. I mean, I can remember trying to lobby the Governor Bredesen at the time, to get his Commissioner of Human Services to pay attention to what was going on there in that shop. So that's 20 years ago.
Sure.
And really getting nowhere with my efforts. And I know there's other lawyers in the state that also tried to persuade them that they needed to do better. But what we have here, as you outlined, is we have the Social Security Administration of the U.S. federal government has made a contract with each of the states, one of which is Tennessee, to handle this function of deciding medically who is a disabled person and maybe who, and then who is not.
Yes.
So there are thousands and thousands of applications filed each year by citizens trying to gain disability benefits.
Sure.
The cases are, they start with sending out all kinds of paperwork to the claimant. You know, what doctors have you been to, this, that, and the other. And the claims representative takes that paperwork and then writes to the doctors and gets medical records and assembles what they can of the medical file.
Yeah, they coordinate the medical file. They order all the records. They get the records in. They follow up. And they also send out forms to the actual person applying for the benefits, as they call them, the claimant,
right,
to have them filled out, an activity of daily living form and also a past work history form.
Right.
And also then, once all the records are in, at that point, they're supposed to sit down, or they should, unless they feel experienced enough or are experienced enough to know, or the case is simple enough to know whether the case needs what we call in short terms, a CE or a clinical evaluation of the person to substantiate more what their limitations are, and a consultative examination.
Right, so they may send them out to a doctor to be examined.
Exactly, and they also may sit down with what they call a state agency medical consultant or medical doctor and discuss the case with them first to decide what's needed on the case. Okay.
So people make a claim for benefits, and this process at what we call the initial determination.
Yes, sir.
And it eventually goes to a physician to review this file.
Yes, every case has to have an MD signature on it. And an MD, they divide the cases up into mental and physical first, and then there's a mental doctor, an MD, does the physical side, and a mental health provider, like a psychologist or I believe it has to be a PhD level psychologist and maybe a master's level psychologist, if memory serves, also has to evaluate the mental health aspects of the case.
And then a decision is made.
Correct.
And so, as a matter of right, if the decision is unfavorable to the claimant, then they can request reconsideration. They go through a similar process. And then, if they're turned down, then the claimant can ask for an administrative law judge hearing.
Correct. All right. That is the process.
So those of us that have been involved in this process for a long time, I would say many attorneys over the years would not even take a case to begin to represent the claimant at the initial or the reconsideration stages because they didn't feel like we could be effective at those stages because the process was so heavy-handed on the other side.
Yes, I'd agree with that.
Tell us more.
Well, what happens is, you know, basically those SAMDs,
state
agency medical doctors, they're the ones with all the power in these cases.
Right.
You know, the way the law is written, the examiner technically makes the decision. But what the examiner does is just apply what the disability limitations that SAMD, the state agency medical doctor, has assigned to that particular claimant.
Right.
And depending on what he assigns, depends on what limitations there are, which then gets corresponded to some different rules. But generally speaking, first off, the SAMDs are very, they're doctors. They don't live in a bubble. they know when they're breaching on an allowance of benefits. And I think here's where the rubber hits the road. Most of them are contracted. They're getting paid per case they look at.
Right.
If they do a denial, and per that article as well, but I knew this when I was there, it was the same thing. A very tiny, tiny, tiny portion of those cases ever get looked at again. It gets denied, it's gone. But if they do an allowance, it's going to be looked at multiple times, most likely. A high percentage of those get looked at. And there's a good, strong likelihood that it's going to get sent back to that doctor's desk, and he's going to have to make some changes again on that case, spending more time on it.
Right.
But the catch is he does not get compensated for that.
Any more for that. Right.
And so therefore, what happens is, and basically this is piecework, the quicker he can get through cases, or he or she, the quicker, the more money he can make, or she. Many people are very honest and work hard and diligently, and there's some very good doctors that I worked with over there.
Right.
But as that article hashed out, it seems that some doctors, through the numbers, are making decisions on limitations of cases every 7 minutes, which I would put forth that you can barely get your computer on and open up all the files that are pertinent within the 7 minute time frame.
Yeah, many of these files, I mean, there are thin files that
sure
don't
are.
That are lacking in medical evidence, but often you have thousands of pages of medical records that require serious time to review.
Yes.
And so fundamentally, the process at initial and reconsideration has been, prominently a process of deciding against people.
It seems to be. And something else I'd like to add to that process, you would think it would be, first off, these limitation write-ups that the doctors do after reviewing the case. You understand it's not just a yes or no box.
Right.
There's supposed to be a written explanation with reference to the file. And these cases always have them. And you would, and if I were to show anybody just an average one, they would look at it and say, how could someone write something like that in 7 or 8 minutes? It's impossible just to type that out. Well, what's going on, or what had started when I was there that I personally witnessed, was they had set up what they call a RFC team. And RFC is just an acronym for residual functional capacity. It's those limitation forms that those doctors fill out.
Okay.
And that team was examiners. And they were the ones that were more experienced examiners. And at the time I was there, they would give people overtime to write those. And then they would be sent to a doctor to sign off on. Well, the reason I say this is basically if the doctor is only spending a few minutes on each one, there's no way he's reading, and it's averaged out through thousands of cases that he's doing, there is no way that he's actually looking at those cases reasonably. I can't see that. It's just my opinion.
Right.
And if he's not looking through the case, then basically you're having someone like I was, a person with a bachelor's degree in an unrelated field, making a decision on someone's disability.
Right.
Because that's the person who made the form.
Right.
And that's wrong.
So what would happen in the many years that I was working in that area, we would take these cases after they've been denied a couple times, take them to the administrative law judge, and 70 or 80%, sometimes as high as 90%, of the time we would get them approved in spite of what the state agency opinion was. Now those figures are changing some. We have our judges are a little more conservative these days than they have been in recent years.
And the rules have changed.
In the early days of doing this, I'm going to say early days, in the late 80s, early 90s, well, it was only a 3-month wait to get an administrative law judge hearing. I remember very well having filed an administrative law judge request, and then, like a week later, hearing from the judge, when do you want to schedule this?
That's incredible.
Yeah, and not really being ready to schedule it because I haven't had a chance to evaluate the case yet. Mm-hmm. But now we're talking about an 18-month or 24-month wait for for an administrative law judge.
They've come down a little bit.
Okay.
When you apply for administrative law judge hearing now, and this is a brand new development over the past year. Okay. I don't know what's going on, where they've sped it up or how they've addressed it, but I seem to be getting my hearings quicker, though on many of my decisions, they're taking longer. But all in all, I'd say from the time you apply for the ALJ level to the time you actually get your decision from the ALJ, right, you're looking at a little less than a year now.
Right.
But the whole process from initial to the end, you're looking at a year and a half to 2 years.
Right. So, which, you know, puts those benefits that a person certainly would be entitled to, you know, it's a hardship on people.
Sure. And, yeah, and those benefits include health insurance. These people, and I'm getting them into my office every month, where they're a trailer truck driver and have a massive heart attack, 60 years old, no health benefits anymore because they lost their job because they had a heart attack and they can't perform their job anymore.
Right.
They can't afford COBRA benefits. They have a mortgage payment to pay or rent to pay. They can't work, and they're desperate. And they can't. I had one gentleman just in my office a month ago who had to get his cardiac medications from the local county health department because he couldn't go in for his follow-up with his cardiologist because he had no insurance and no money.
Wow.
And the man had quadruple bypass surgery 6 months prior. That's terrible.
Yeah, and so someone at the state agency looked at that case and determined that he could continue to do medium or heavy work, and was not a disabled person.
But with that case, that's a very beginning one, so I don't know how that particular one has come out, but I have seen that scenario happen many times.
Right.
Just like that.
Right. So Bill, what do you do with a case when, I mean, are you taking cases at the initial stage or at the reconsideration stage?
I do. I take them at the initial stage right up through because that way I can develop the case from the beginning.
Right.
I even have staff now to help me to make sure that things are starting to get ordered and followed up with at the beginning levels. Those examiners at the state agency, well, quite frankly, they're overwhelmed. I had that job before. It's difficult. It's difficult in that they're assigned cases every day. They take a vacation day, they're assigned cases. They take a vacation week, they're assigned cases. They call in sick, they're assigned cases. It snows out. If the person who assigns cases was able to come in, they're assigned cases.
So they don't clear.
It never stops.
Yeah.
So they keep coming in. And matter of fact, and this is another issue, is the ones that are more conscientious to develop the record properly, meaning get the proper records in the file, that takes time.
Right.
Time is something they don't have. Their employee evaluation, the main thing everyone is looking at and the main thing that's hawked upon is processing time. They don't care about the outcome. It's how many cases have you closed or cleared, and how many cases do you currently have in your caseload? So, I mean, I don't know what the caseload average is now, but predominantly it's been from 150 to 250 over the last 10 years, somewhere in between those two numbers, on an examiner's desk at one time throughout, you know, the last 10 years. I mean, it's overwhelming for them. So if I take it from my clients, I can help them because I can make sure that, A, the case is developed properly, in that I make sure those records are gotten, and help the examiner get the records if they can't. And B, I can also make sure that the physicians are filling out proper forms to give proper opinions on the person's conditions and proper limitations. Doctors who actually see and treat the person.
Right.
Hopefully, they still have insurance or have the ability to see a doctor at that point.
Right.
And many do, but many don't. But when they do, I'm able to supplement the record with an opinion from an actual doctor who spent time with them. And that's massively advantageous to the claimant. Sometimes we are able to get them benefits at that initial and reconsideration level by putting it together properly like that. But as you said in the past, it's a bear. It is a bear still.
Well, Bill, you know, I was excited to read this article that the Tennessean reporter put together, really uncovering, as you just described, the fact that these doctors are doing these cases, evaluating these cases on a piecemeal basis, piecework type basis, I guess is the better phrase to use, getting paid by each case that they do. And they reported that one doctor was doing them in 15 minutes or less and made like $400,000 on a part-time basis.
Incredible.
Just churning out these cases. And of course, most of them are denials. I was excited to see this fact exposed, and it seems to have brought it the needed attention to the problem from a political standpoint.
This is something I'm looking forward to as well.
Yeah, we had made efforts previously to get the attention of people in the higher echelons of our state government, really to no avail. Because I think that many times our state legislators or even the governors and commissioners, okay, well, this is the federal Social Security program. This is not a state-level program. What role do we have to play in it? Right?
Yes.
But in fact, they actually do have a role to play if they would play it.
Sure.
Right. So I've talked to many legislators over the years who really didn't understand that the state was involved in this process. Is that your experience?
That's mine as well. And the other thing is, for the politicians, this is to great advantage for the Tennesseans, for their residents, their constituents. I think a lot of this gets lost, almost like it's, you know, quote unquote, an entitlement program or something to that effect. Most of these people are hardworking Tennessee residents, like that person I described earlier, 60 years old, been a trailer truck driver his whole life.
Right.
He paid into this system to have this safety net for himself. This man is not going to be, he's going to go from a $50,000 a year job to probably collecting $1,400 a month for his disability insurance benefit, which just mirrors his retirement benefit.
Right.
It's what he paid in for. It's what everybody retires to. And it gives him the opportunity to get Medicare, which is the health benefit that he desperately needs. And I think that the more streamlined that they can get the DDS, the disability determination section, or the more efficient to get proper decisions out and more thorough decisions out. And let's mention this too. As Tennesseans, we're also federal taxpayers, not just state taxpayers. That doctor who's pressing that button for his signature on that computer is being paid by the taxpayers. And he's getting paid a lot of money for an opinion, a thought out medical opinion from a licensed professional.
Right.
And if he's not given that, then us taxpayers are getting ripped off.
Right.
That gentleman who was the truck driver got ripped off. And if he's getting ripped off, we're all getting ripped off.
Right. Well, it doesn't help. It doesn't help anybody for people to be, pauperized by improper decision making.
Sure.
So you have people who can't pay their rent, who have to go get food stamps. They become homeless in the process.
I think that brings to the next point, right, which is that also, if the correct decision is made in a timely fashion, then that person is not costing Tennessee any more money. You know, when that person loses his home, now he's reaching out to community services that are costing money. Now he's...
In fact, the inverse is true. In other words,
exactly.
The wrong decision is costing the state money.
Exactly. Health-wise.
Right.
You know, that person with the cardiac problem, he has another cardiac event and he's got to go to the emergency room because he wasn't able to go to his cardiologist properly, is going to cost a fortune.
Yeah. So a person who is officially declared disabled is entitled to some sort of medical benefit, whether it be Medicaid or Medicare.
Sure.
And so all of a sudden now we have people that are able to pay their doctors rather than just relying on charity care. So there's also money available for people who are declared to be disabled for rehabilitation services. So, and that's to everyone's benefit, is to try to get these people back to work if you can.
In my experience, many of my clients, Mark, you did this for 20, 30, I don't know how many years you did it for. My experience was I get many, many clients who, A, use vocational rehab services and get back to work. I have a gentleman who had a bad back, terrible back, and he was disabled, and he went to voc rehab after he got his disability and was able to get, he ended up getting himself retrained at the age of 55 to learn how to be a computer draftsman.
Wow.
And he got a job that he can work around, so he's no longer on benefits anymore because he opted to work because he makes a lot more money. And I know many clients who've done that, not just at that high level, but even at lower levels where they just need to get that medical attention in a couple years to get them back going again. And once they're back going again, they're contributing tax dollars to us.
So Bill, isn't it interesting that this news article that has prompted this conversation we're having today and is also prompting conversations among the legislators. I've seen reporting that the chair people of the various committees involved with this are wanting to look into this process.
Yeah, and that is exciting.
It is exciting, and it's interesting that it's coincidental with the new governor coming in.
Yes.
Do you have any hopes or aspirations about that?
I do. With the new administration, this is how our system works here in America. We get to vote in a new administration, a changing of the guard, so to speak, and things get to be looked at anew and afresh. And I hope wholeheartedly that Governor Lee is going to look at this and make some changes or address the issue, or at least be more aware of it than past administrations.
Right.
I think that's the main thing. I don't even think many of the fixes that could be done won't cost Tennessee any money. It'll just save them money.
Right.
And it'll help Tennesseans. And that's the big thing. And I think we could all agree on that, no matter what political affiliation, what denomination, what anything. This is just a bonus plan is what it is. And I'm hopeful for it, and I'm excited about it. I was glad to see the article.
Well, I'm hoping that our listeners will be paying attention to this, and if they have an opportunity to speak with their state legislator or their state senator, that they would voice an interest in this. And so let's keep our fingers crossed and be watching for what's happening as this thing develops.
I will be following it closely.
Well, Bill, thank you for coming in and speaking.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mark.
Lots of fun.
Yes.